Listeners of Undisclosed, stick around after the credits. We've got an exclusive interview with the host of the debuting podcast, Military Justice. His name is James Wyrick. The podcast drops tomorrow, September 20th. We're going to be talking to him immediately after today's episode. Also, three great sponsors this week. They include Stamps.com, the debuting ABC drama, Conviction, and The Great Courses Plus. Listen in for those spots and make sure you support our supporters because they support us. Let's get to today's episode.
In prosecuting Joey Watkins for the murder of Isaac Dawkins, the prosecutor, Tammy Colston, was kind of stuck. She didn't actually have any physical evidence tying him to the crime. Instead, she had to rely on convincing the jury that in the past, Joey had shown hostility towards Isaac, and that there had been something called prior difficulties between them. Hi, and welcome to episode 10 of Undisclosed, Out of Character. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney, a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and the author of Adnan's Story. Of course, I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney with the Volkov Law Group, and I blog at viewfromll2.com.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. In 1813, Jane Austen published her novel Pride and Prejudice. The protagonist, Elizabeth Bennet, begins the novel thinking she can tell right after meeting a person, or maybe even before she meets him, that he is full of pride or full of prejudice. With regard to Mr. Darcy, Elizabeth believes him to be arrogant and merciless after hearing and believing that he has cheated George Wickham out of his inheritance. It is only after learning more about Darcy and Wickham that Elizabeth is able to put aside her prejudice, her prejudgment, and see Mr. Darcy for who he really is. This helps explain why Austen initially titled her novel First Impressions. There's something else, however, that Elizabeth says early in the book that ends up ringing true. Quote, "The distance is none when one has a motive." Elizabeth is speaking about the climb every mountain ethos in which no obstacle is too tall in life when you have a dream, a goal, a motivation. But the quote also applies in criminal courtrooms every day and in a way that relates back to Elizabeth's first impression of Mr. Darcy. Motive, means, and opportunity are often thought as the holy trinity of a murder prosecution. Now, this is a slight misnomer because motive actually isn't an element of the crime of murder. That said, it is something the prosecution certainly wants to prove to close the gap between doubt and guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. In some cases, that distance is literal. The problem of proving the defendant killed his ex-girlfriend's new boyfriend despite the fact that they had broken up months earlier, or the problem of placing the defendant at the crime scene when witnesses claim he was at his house too late to make it to the site of the shooting. In such cases, the prosecution would love to rely upon prior friction between the defendant and the victim as a surrogate for evidence connected to the crime itself. Typically, however, character evidence is inadmissible because you want a jury to convict based upon evidence of the crime at issue and not based upon the defendant's prior bad acts. That said, courts have carved out an exception when those prior acts involve both the defendant and the victim. As the Supreme Court of Georgia noted in rejecting the appeal of Devonia Inman, another GIP client, while motive is not an essential element in the proof of the crime of murder, the state is entitled to present evidence to establish that there was a motive, and evidence which is relevant to an issue in a case is not rendered inadmissible by the fact that it incidentally puts the defendant's character in issue. This type of character was at the very center of the prosecution of Joey Watkins for the murder of Isaac Dawkins, but as Yeats noted in The Second Coming, sometimes the center cannot hold, and the ceremony of innocence is drowned.
The state faced a big problem in prosecuting Joey Watkins. It didn't have much evidence that he'd actually shot Isaac. To make up for this lack of evidence that Joey did do it, they instead made a two-step case that, one, Joey would have shot Isaac, given the opportunity, and two, there wasn't anyone else who would have shot Isaac. Therefore, they say, since Isaac had in fact been shot, Joey was necessarily the shooter.
This two-step plan didn't let the state totally off the hook.
It would still require evidence that Joey would, in fact, have shot Isaac, given the chance. And at the very start of the investigation, it looked like the state was off to a great start. Evidence that Joey had shot at Isaac on a previous date was fantastic evidence that he would have been able to shoot Isaac on January 11th. But after the Panama City incident fell apart, the state's case for showing that Joey would have done it was left just as thin as the case showing that he did do it. That is, until Stanley Sutton came along. Sutton couldn't do much to fix the lack of evidence showing that Joey did it, but what he succeeded in doing was convincing friends of Joey and Isaac to make statements they had never made before about Joey's hostility towards Isaac.
Now, as I noted before, typically the prosecution can't present character evidence against a defendant. That's evidence of prior bad acts unconnected to the crime charged. That said, if the prosecution wants to present evidence under the exception allowing evidence to prove motive, it can file a notice of character evidence it wants to introduce. And in this case, when the prosecution filed its notice, it listed 6 prior difficulties between Joey and Isaac that it claimed formed the motive in this case. It also pointed out that it had more than double the number of quote-unquote similar transactions. These were prior acts by Joey that did not involve Isaac, and we'll get to those later. But returning to those prior difficulties, the prosecution claimed it had 6 examples that it could use to prove this animus between Joey and Isaac and a reason for Joey not only to want to harm Isaac, but also to kill him.
The first category on Tammy Colson's notice for prior difficulties stated the following. During the time period between June of 1999 and January 2000, the victim, Isaac Dawkins, was harassed by the defendant, Joey Watkins, on numerous occasions. This forms the basis of the charge of stalking contained in the indictment. Mr. Watkins threatened Isaac Dawkins and told others he was going to get him. Although these incidents are evidence of prior difficulties and are evidence of the crime of stalking and are not similar transactions, the state places defendant on notice that it intends to introduce all prior threats by Joey Watkins against Isaac Dawkins, as well as specific incidents where Joey Watkins attacked Isaac Dawkins or chased him with a vehicle. Some of the specific acts are as follows.
So here is the limiting instruction that the judge gave to the jury in Joey's trial. And this is so the jury can think about prior difficulties and similar transactions as they are presented by the prosecution and decide for themselves whether they met the bar. And here's what the judge said. I instruct you that before you may consider any other transaction for the limited purpose I have referred to, you must first determine whether this accused committed the other transaction. And if so, whether any such act was similar enough to the crime charged in this indictment, so that proof of another transaction, in light of the limited purpose for which it has been presented to you, would tend to prove an element of a crime charged in this indictment. So let's now look at the prior difficulties that were alleged by the state.
First up involves Isaac's dog. According to the notice, between June of 1999 and August 1999, Isaac Dawkins' dog was shot between the eyes while in its pen at the Dawkins home. The dog was shot with a .22 caliber weapon. The victim's dog was shot because Isaac Dawkins was dating Breanne Scarber. We've already mentioned before that at trial, Tammy Colston alleged that Joey had killed Isaac's dog at some point prior to the murder, although it's a little bit fuzzy when, and how jailhouse snitches were used in part to link Joey to Sally's death, Sally being Isaac's black and tan coonhound. And we'll be getting a lot more into this in the future, but for now, I just wanted to point out what a mess the state's prior transaction notice was, even for this very first event. I have no idea, for instance, why Colson wrote that the dog was shot between June of 99 and August of 99, because none of her witnesses testified to this. Eventually, a few seemed to decide it happened probably around October 1st, but Colson was well aware of that long before this notice was written, and I'm not sure why she gave these different dates instead. And there's also the fact that the notice doesn't even identify who shot the dog, just that it had been shot and that it was because Isaac was dating Breanne. But that can't be true because all the witnesses seem to claim that the dog was shot after Breanne and Isaac had broken up. And then there is a very strange comment about how Sally had been shot with a .22 caliber weapon. But here's the thing. Sally's body was never actually found. It was never recovered. No bullets were ever tested. It was never inspected in any way. So how is Colson claiming to know that a 22 caliber weapon was used to kill her.
So the second incident that's noted as a prior difficulty on the notice given by the state was the Checkers incident. And we discussed this at length in episode 3. But let me read to you. Between June of 1999 and January of 2000, Joey Watkins was in his vehicle and was harassing Brian Scarborough, who was in a vehicle with others in downtown Rome. Isaac saw the harassment and approached Joey Watkins. Joey Watkins told Isaac Dawkins to come to his house. Isaac did. Joey Watkins went to the window of Isaac's vehicle and started hitting him through the window. Now, based on the prior transaction notice, it looks like Colston decided to go 100% with the version of the story told by Brian. No one other than Brian says that happened, and everyone else who was there agreed it happened actually in a totally different way. Then again, Colston couldn't even figure out when this happened, or at least couldn't narrow it down beyond a 6-month time frame, so maybe she didn't realize that Brian's story was an unsupported outlier. But again, before Sutton took over the case, this was the only story that anyone had ever mentioned involving Joey and Isaac having a physical altercation. It's the only one that Isaac's best friend Jay Barnett ever mentioned, the only one of any Isaac's ex-girlfriends ever mentioned, and only one Joey's friends ever mentioned.
The only one that is, aside from the Panama City incident. But at the time that Mosher handed over this case to the Floyd County Police Department, this was the only time he'd ever heard of from any witness, from any friend, any family member, of Isaac and Joey having a fight. And it wasn't really much of a fight. What we know of it is, again, Isaac and Joey encounter each other. They were cruising out in the street. Joey says, well, yeah, you want to fight? Follow me back to my house. Isaac follows Joey. They get there. They have a long standoff. Neither really does much. Joey tries to punch Isaac, but hits the truck instead. And then Isaac bails and goes to meet friends at Applebee's. So it's not really a similar transaction if you're comparing it to murder.
We're going to take a short break now to check in with one of our sponsors. I get asked a lot about what I think the role of media has been in the criminal justice system, especially on issues of reform, wrongful convictions, youth incarceration, and so forth. And honestly, I think it's been tremendous. The impact has been tangible, not only in the kinds of changes we're seeing on the ground, but also really in the media itself, in the kinds of stories that we seem to be interested in. I remember growing up and watching a lot of crime-based fiction and nonfiction, you know, TV shows, and a lot of them were really about police getting the right guy. They always got the right guy. Now we're coming to the realization that, you know what, we don't always get the right guy. And there's a new crime drama coming to ABC on Monday nights this fall that is gonna explore that exact thing. This new show is called Conviction, and it stars Haley Atwell as Hayes Morrison, an attorney with her heart in the right place, but sometimes manages to get into a little bit of trouble, who is hand-selected by the city's DA to lead their new conviction integrity unit. Now, this premise is actually inspired by real life because across the country, conviction integrity units are being established by prosecutors who are taking a look at cases that maybe shouldn't have been prosecuted to begin with. The investigative team on Conviction doesn't put people in prison. Their job is to help free the wrongfully convicted, and they've only got 5 days per case to do it. The show is set in the fast-paced, gritty legal world of New York City, and of course, showcases the American justice system at large. It also stars Emily Kenney of The Walking Dead and Eddie Cahill from CSI New York. Every episode is going to have lots of twists and turns, so you don't want to miss it. Coming from the executive producer of Criminal Minds, Conviction will be on ABC Mondays this fall at 10/9 Central, starting on October 3rd, right after Dancing with the Stars. Make sure to tune in.
While the Checkers incident wasn't really similar to the crime at issue, this next one listed in the notice arguably was. And I'm reading from the language of the notice. During the same period of time, Adam Elrod, Travis Camp, and Joey Watkins were on Highway 27 north of Mount Berry Square Mall during the time Isaac was dating Brianne. Isaac was with Jay Barnett in a white truck. Joey Watkins saw Isaac Dawkins and chased Isaac down the road. Isaac got away from Joey on this occasion. Now, to put this in context, Adam Elrod was a former classmate and friend of Joey's. On direct examination, Adam testified that he recalled an incident from around September 1999 in which Joey was chasing Isaac down Highway 27 by Armurchie. According to Adam, he was in his pickup truck with his friend Travis Camp when he saw Joey flying past him in hot pursuit of Isaac. Adam claimed that Joey then, quote, swerved over to Isaac, but he slid his tires so hard that night that it left flat places in his tires. And according to Adam, Joey was driving a 1985 silver and blue Chevy Silverado and, quote, I know it was Joey Silverado. During the defense case, however, defense attorney Rex Abernathy called Dale Camp, Travis's father, and according to Travis, Joey's father did have a 1985 silver and blue Chevy Silverado at his dealership, but he sold it to Dale on November 7th, 1998. And there's no need to take Dale's word in this. The defense actually produced a document showing that Dale took out a loan on the vehicle on that same date, 10 months before the supposed incident described by Adam. Moreover, according to Dale, he had never loaned the Silverado to Joey, and it would have been parked at his job at Associated Distributors at the time of the alleged incident. Abernathy's last question to Dale was, quote, so if someone testified that they saw Joey in September 1999 driving your truck, chasing somebody up the road, that wouldn't be true, would it? Dale's response, no, sir, that would not be true. But it wasn't just Dale who denied this event. It was also his son, Travis. Now recall, according to the story told by Adam, Travis was in the vehicle with Adam at the time that he saw this chase taking place between Joey and Isaac. And here's the long and short of defense attorney's direct examination of Travis. Question, did you have an occasion around September of 1999 to be in a vehicle with Adam Elrod on US Highway 27 in the Armurchie area and see either Joey Watkins or Isaac Dawkins pass you? Answer, no. Question, did you have an occasion to see Joey Watkins chasing Isaac Dawkins in a Silverado? Answer, no. Question, were you ever in a vehicle at that time to the best of your knowledge with Adam Elrod? Answer, no. Question, have you ever seen Joey Watkins chase Isaac Dawkins on any occasion? Answer, no.
At any rate, it's no surprise that this whole story about seeing Joey chase Isaac on Highway 27 North, it's no surprise it came from Adam Elrod, because Adam Elrod has tons of stories. I mean, usually it's not the same story 2 days in a row, but he makes up in quantity what he lacks in consistency. And Adam's stories are never held back by the fact that the people these stories are about never agree with Adam about how they occurred, or usually even if they occurred. I mean, Adam, for instance, is the source of the story about Joey buying a gun from the scraggly man down in Cedartown. And Adam's the one who has all kinds of bad acts that supposedly Joey had done, or people that Joey had tried to beat up. How Joey has no friends, although he's also one of Joey's best friends. That's why Joey told him stuff. So, but Adam's also the first person, and for a long time only person, to come forward with claims about hearing Joey threaten to kill Isaac. Although a few others have said they heard Joey say a couple of times while Isaac and Brian were dating that he was going to, quote unquote, whoop Isaac's ass, no one ever said that Joey had threatened worse than that until Adam started to say it.
Let me ask you another thing. Have you ever heard Joey ever say, I'm going to kill Isaac?
Oh, I'll kill that son of a bitch. I've heard that come out of his mouth a few times. When he called us, me and Todd, when he came to Todd's house that one time, after he found out all the stuff about Brian and Isaac, he had said that to me. I couldn't tell you how many times.
Why do you think he said he was going to kill Isaac? He told you several times.
He's just stupid. He was so obsessed with this girl. I don't know why. She's not that much to look at.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a pretty girl, but I mean, they grow on trees like that every day.
But you said he was so obsessed with Brienne and hated Isaac. And you heard him say he's going to kill him how many times before in the past?
Several times.
Now, Adam claims, like I said, that he's not even really Joey's friend, but he's somehow heard Joey threaten to kill Isaac several times, even though before Adam, not a single person had ever heard this. Paul Allen, for instance, never heard Joey threaten to kill Isaac. Neither did Jay Barnett, or Chad Redden, or Clay Burkhalter, or Brian Scarber, or Aslan Hoag, or Erica Evans, or anyone else, with one notable exception we'll get into later, from a woman who claims that Joey threatened to kill Isaac months before Brianne and Isaac ever even dated. But other than that, Adam Elrod is the only person on Earth who says that he heard Joey threaten to kill Isaac. Why? Well,
as far as I can tell, the worst liar is Adam Elrod.
Yes.
Because he's just, they're not even, I mean, he's even worse than Josh Flimster.
Right.
Adam just, like, I can't even find a source for his stories. Like, for everyone else, they'll give a story, and I'm like, okay, this is this event here. And they're talking about this thing that happened in real life and giving it a twist this way. For Adam, it's just, what is that boy talking about?
Right. Adam is a compulsive liar. Adam is a pathological liar. He will tell a lie and then he'll make himself believe it so he doesn't screw up when he's telling the story to someone else.
So when Adam tells the story about Joey chasing Isaac on 27, he puts two other witnesses there, Travis Camp and Jay Barnett, Isaac's best friend, who was supposedly in the truck with Isaac. Travis obviously doesn't support Adam's story, but how about Jay? Well, not at first. In his tape statement in June 2001, just a couple of months before Joey's trial, Jay initially denies that Isaac had ever told him about any run-ins with Joey.
Had he ever mentioned that he had run-ins with Joey Watkins before? Never mentioned to you?
This answer makes sense. Jay obviously never told Detective Moser about any of these incidents, and as Isaac's closest friend, it's hard to imagine why he would have held back that kind of information. But a little while later, in the same interview, Jay changes his mind. Isaac apparently did tell him about Joey chasing him.
Had he ever threatened to kill him or anything in your presence?
Mm-hmm. Not in my knowledge. Just threatened to whip his ass and stuff like that.
Did Isaac ever tell you about the time he chased, any chases that Joey chased him, anything?
Yeah, he said Joey had come up behind him several times and had tried to run him off the road, and Isaac had started carrying a gun in his truck around the same time that all this stuff started happening.
Still, Jay is clear. Isaac may have mentioned being chased, but Jay had never been with him when it happened.
But there's no other incident that you know of other than Isaac telling you that Joey had chased him down several times trying to run him off the road.
No, not that I'd been with him.
Then during the trials, though, something changed. Jay suddenly did recall being with Isaac when Joey was chasing them on Highway 27 North, just like Adam Elrod had said.
All right, now, Jay, was there a third incident that happened up on Highway 27 North?
Yes.
What happened there?
Joey kept pulling in front of Isaac, slamming on his brakes, getting up beside him, trying to run him off the road. Just kept doing that for probably 5 to 10 minutes. He kept pulling in front of him, slamming on the brakes, trying to get him to hit him, and trying to get him to follow his everything else.
Did he have somebody with him then, Joey?
I can't tell. He had tinted windows, so it's hard to tell unless he had the windows rolled down. I never saw the windows roll down, I don't think.
About what time did this happen, roughly?
I want to say this was in the winter.
So that was well after he broke up with Brianne?
Yeah, he was already dating somebody else at that time.
Okay, so kind of just like Adam Elrod said, the gist is there. It's roughly similar. It's clearly talking about a Highway 27 North chase, but Adam and Jay still don't agree on most of the details. Still, if this happened, if, like Jay says, there was an incident involving Joey's truck trying to run Isaac's truck off the road, why didn't Jay ever mention it to Detective Mosier? Why did Jay, in fact, deny that anything like that had happened when Stanley Sutton asked him about it in his taped interview? And if Jay had been with Isaac when Joey had threatened both their lives by trying to run the truck off the road, why didn't Jay remember anything about it until after Adam Elrod had told Stanley Sutton it had happened?
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking, and in his first interview, he did change his mind, and that was apparently before Sutton got the information from Adam, right?
Long after. So for some reason, Jay, even though he's Isaac's very best friend, and like they're together every day, all day from the sounds of it, from what Jay says, he's not interviewed on tape until April 2001. So that's like, what, 14 months after Isaac's death? Now, it's worth noting that by the time of trial, Jay himself was actually a Floyd County police officer. But when he talked to Mosier, and he talked to Mosier a bunch when Mosier had the case, he never mentions this. He never talks about these chases. He never talks about everything that, aside from the Panama City incident and that fight after they didn't meet at Checkers.
I just find the whole thing so weird because if we're breaking it down, Adam says, I'm in my pickup truck with Travis Kemp and I see Joey in this Chevy Silverado. And yet that Chevy Silverado he's talking about belongs to Travis's father. The father says Joey would have never been driving it. And Travis says, I'm not in the pickup truck when this happens. In fact, I never saw anything like this. So I don't know. It's almost like a blender where there's these odd facts and I don't understand how they come together, but it's just a bunch of mush instead of something really solid that the jury can hang their hats on here.
I mean, it's really hard to break down who's talking about what, because you have variations on a theme. And it's only after a lot of digging you realize that two people were talking about the exact same event in a certain statement. And then just to make things worse, you have Adam, who's just making up stuff off the cuff, which no other witness talks about, no other witness has ever heard of until possibly a trial when they suddenly recall it. So trying to make Adam's stories fit with the rest of the various collection, it wasn't fun. It was hard. Like, I have a very large file with details on every single statement we have about each of these events. And just trying to figure out who's talking about what is never straightforward. Because, again, like Jay, their statements initially say stuff didn't happen until we get to trial, when suddenly they say it did.
Now, the fourth incident listed in the Notice of Prior Difficulties reads as follows. In the summer of 1999, Adam Elrod, Joey Watkins, Clay Burkhalter, and DJ Gammon were together on Highway 140. Isaac Dawkins came by with Paul Allen. Joey Watkins again chased Isaac Dawkins down. The police stopped the vehicle Joey Watkins was in and arrested several of the people inside for underage possession of alcohol. Now, this one did take place in the summer of 1999, and Adam, Joey, Clay, and DJ did get arrested for underage possession of alcohol, but that's pretty much where the similarities with reality end. Basically, what happened is that Joey's girlfriend at the time, Shay Highfield, had a barbecue at her place, and Joey and a bunch of friends were there. Paul Allen, who had previously dated Shay, was not invited, but he showed up anyway. He drove by, and when he saw Shay and Joey outside, he threw some firecrackers at them and drove off. So Joey and Shay ran inside yelling about it, and Clay jumped in his truck to chase Paul, and he was joined in his truck by Joey and three others who piled in, with the truck then taking off. Here's what Joey's friend Clay told Sutton in his interview about this event.
Were you with him one night when him and you and Adam Elrod and several other people were in a truck and chased Paul Allen and Isaac Dawkins down on Highway 140?
Yes, sir.
Do you know when that happened?
It was last summer, the summer of 99, and when Joey came in the house, it was, to my knowledge, that it was Paul Allen by himself, and that Paul had done something to Joey and Shay Highfield on her four-wheeler, who was at her residence, and that I knew, he said it was Paul, so we chased him. We came out on the old Dalton Road and turned left onto Highway 140.
Whose vehicle were y'all in?
It was my Nissan pickup.
Okay. What were y'all chasing?
Paul Allen's black Camaro.
So as he says in his answer, to my knowledge, it was just Paul Allen by himself. So why is this evidence of Joey stalking Isaac? In fact, it doesn't seem like anyone even knew Isaac was in the car with Paul, and I'm not really convinced he was even along for the ride at all. Paul testified that Isaac had been with him that day, but he agrees that there was no reason to think that anyone else knew about it. So here's Paul testifying at trial.
Question. Did Shay and Joey even know Isaac was even in your car? Answer. I have no idea. Question. All right. Now, you said when the truck was chasing around, no one was yelling Isaac's name, were they? They were just yelling your name. Answer, yes, sir.
So why in the world does this get turned into evidence that Joey killed Isaac? Well, unfortunately, Adam Elrod was also one of the guys who hopped into the truck to chase Paul. And even though everyone else seems to have forgotten that Isaac had anything to do with this event, Adam remembers that the whole point of it was to chase Isaac. Sutton's notes from March 2000 say, Adam Elrod stated to Sutton that they were chasing after Isaac. So that's the story Tammy Colston decides to use in prosecuting Joey. Which was a big mistake, because by the time Adam was interviewed on tape in December, he'd actually forgotten the story he was supposed to run with.
You talked about how he chased him on Highway 140.
Yeah, whenever that was, it was summertime because we were swimming, cooking out. Him and Paul Allen was together.
And what kind of car were they in?
Clay said they was in a black Camaro, and that's Paul all day long.
Yeah.
And they had thrown something out in the yard and was shooting firecrackers. Well, Joey was on a four-wheeler to start with. Well, I was fixing to back my truck out and go out of the driveway. And Clay said, come on, we'll just go in my truck. I jumped in the cab. DJ jumps on back. Justin Cooper's on back. And Joey gets on back. We're going down 140. We pass the first bridge after you leave Shea Highfield's house. We was running 80, 85 mile an hour.
In fact, by the time trial comes along, Adam has forgotten about the chase at Shea Highfield's house altogether. Colston tries to prompt his memory, but Adam's got nothing. Poor Colston. This time, she can't even blame Adam's screw-up on Detective Mosher.
Yeah, and this actually forms a partial basis for Joey's appeal after his conviction, because Tammy Colston, we can tell from her notice, is claiming that Isaac is at the heart of this interaction and was the reason for the chase. And as you can see, Adam at trial has conveniently forgotten the story, and so when the defense is arguing for new trial, they write the following in their brief. Specifically, the state over Watkins' objection introduced bad acts of Watkins during a barbecue. The state assured the court that this incident involved Watkins and the deceased. However, the testimony actually presented at trial showed that the deceased was not involved in any way in the alleged incident. But as a result of the introduction of said testimony, unfavorable and highly prejudicial character evidence was introduced against Watkins when it should have been excluded altogether.
What I like about this story from Adam is that not only is he going ahead and saying that, you know, Joey wanted to kill Isaac or chase Isaac or run him off the road, but he just throws the rest of the crowd under the bus too. He's like, oh yeah, Clay Burkhalter, DJ Gammon, they were also trying to chase Isaac off the road that night. So Adam does not limit his defamation to just Joey. He's happy to claim that anyone wanted to kill Isaac.
Right, Susan, because according to this story, it's Clay who takes off to chase Paul and Joey just piles in, right? So he's not even the one who's instigating this. He's just joining in with Clay who's taking up the chase.
Yeah, he's in the back of the truck, like standing up, and they're yelling at Paul because Paul drove by and he threw firecrackers at him. I mean, Paul eventually claims that Isaac's there in the Camaro with him, and maybe he was. I have no way of saying he wasn't. But there certainly isn't any evidence of that until we get to Adam. And even Paul agrees, if Isaac was with him when they went to throw firecrackers at Joey and Shay, no one else knew about it.
And I also struggle to see how this really is proof of anything in this case, because the state isn't alleging that Isaac did anything to Joey. And in fact, this incident doesn't involve Isaac doing anything to Joey. It's Paul throwing firecrackers at Shay and Joey. And I mean, naturally, someone's going to react, and there's not actually any violence that occurs here. It's just they're upset and maybe they drive after him. But yeah, I don't really see how at all this relates to the allegations against Joey at trial.
Yeah, and this is not relevant either to anything about Joey, but I did like how in cross-examination, Paul's trying to play this off as he just happened to be passing by Shay's house when they started chasing him. And the defense points out that that's not actually the way Paul would want to go home unless he was, you know, wanting to be seen there.
I did not have a similar, like, teenager year to time. Like, is this just that there's not enough to do in Rome? Or is this, I don't know, is this teenager behavior that I just never engaged in? Like, I'm amazed at how much, like, back and forth. And even though they're not serious altercations, they're just kind of constantly just messing with each other, these guys.
I was talking to Tandy the other night, and she was like, well, there are only two options for us. It was to go to the parking lot at Mount Berry Square or go to the parking lot at Home Depot. Those are your weekend excitements for Rome, Georgia, apparently, if you're a teenager.
You know that feeling you get when you can get things done with just the click of your mouse? It can't get more convenient than that. And now, you can even get your mailing and shipping done without leaving your desk, thanks to Stamps.com. Stamps.com turns your PC or Mac into your own personal post office that never closes. You can buy and print official US postage for any letter or package using your computer or printer. Then, you just hand your mail to the mailman or drop it in the mailbox. You'll never have to go to the post office again. I'm working on a new case, not sure if it'll be for the podcast, my blog, or an article, but Stamps.com has made it so easy to send mail to a variety of sources trying to get more information. And right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in UNDISCLOSED. That's Stamps.com. Enter UNDISCLOSED.
So the next prior difficulty that the state brings up is an incident about Brianne's mom's minivan. And here's what they write. During the spring or summer of 1999, Joey Watkins saw Isaac Dawkins' truck at Brianne Scarborough's house one evening and shot at Isaac Dawkins' truck. Now, on September 12, 1999, Brianne's stepfather did file a police report stating that, overnight, the back window of the family's minivan had gotten busted out. Joey got blamed for it, of course, but there was never any suggestion that Isaac was even involved in any way. Until, of course, again, surprisingly, Adam Elrod came along.
So in September 99, the back windows of her mom's van got, like, blown out or broken in the middle of the night.
I had nothing to do with it.
And they blamed you for it, obviously.
They blame me for everything.
Adam Elrod says that the two of you were together and that you threw rocks at the window.
Adam's a damn liar.
Brianne herself had actually never mentioned Isaac being involved with the van windows thing, but at trial, she runs with Adam's story.
Adam Elrod was a friend of Joey's, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he told you, he came to you and told you he was sorry for what?
Yeah. He told me, he was like, you know, look, I'm sorry for Joey, and I'm sorry that I was ever friends with him. He was like, but I was with him when he did that.
Did what?
He busted, Joey shot out my mom's window with a slingshot.
When did this happen?
It was when me and Isaac were going out, so sometime this summer.
But on cross-examination at Joey's trial, Brianne took it further and claimed for the first time that this incident was not just something that Joey had done. It was something he had done because of his jealousy of Isaac. Question, I guess, and there was never during all these June through September that anything that ever had happened while you were out with Isaac that Joey did to you is there that you're aware of? Answer, my window to my van got shot out. Question. I am talking about when you were out with Isaac and there was some type of public confrontation or something. The two of you together? Answer. Well, Isaac was at my house that night.
Isaac's best friend, however, seems totally unaware that this is the official version of events, because he gives a much different version of where Isaac was when this all happened.
All right, do you know of any other incidents that Isaac and Joey had?
I know that a few times out at Brianne's house, you know, I'd be with Isaac or something, and she'd call or page him, and then she'd want him to come out there like right then because she said Joey had been calling, making threats to her and everything else, and she wanted Isaac to come out there right then. And one time we got out there, and her I think the back of her mom's van or something was, the windows were all busted out in it. It was like after we got there.
And it's worth noting that Joey's trial is actually not the last time that the van windows thing gets brought up. In fact, in 2006, while filing charges against Joey in Troup County, Breanne brings it up again, this time to an investigator there. Although, unsurprisingly perhaps, this time the story has a new twist to it. From the investigator's report, it says, Breanne advised me of one more report that was made when someone shot at her mother's residence in Rome, Georgia. Breanne stated that police officers found Joseph Watkins in the area, but no charges were filed against him in the case. Breanne stated that Joseph Watkins lived on the other side of town at that time. And in case it needs to be clarified, no, that didn't happen. Joey was never connected in any way to the van windows thing until after Isaac's murder. Yeah, I don't know why Breanne decides to wait until 2006 to start improving the story, but it probably would have helped Tammy Colston if she'd thought to make that up at trial.
Well, it could have, right? But it could have also blown up in their face because they could have actually checked to see whether there was actually any interaction between Joey and the police, and there wouldn't have been, right? This could have definitively refuted that claim.
See, you say that, but, and it makes sense, but that hasn't applied to other cases where claims like that were made. Anyway, it's clear from what Jay Barnett says, because he recalls this incident. He recalls being with Isaac when Breanne says, hey, someone shut out the windows for my van. Come and protect me, quick. So clearly he was not at Breanne's house that night, like Breanne testified.
This then takes us to the final prior difficulty listed in the state's notice, and it reads as follows. In September of 1999, Joey Watkins chased Isaac Dawkins up Highway 27 North. He tried to run Isaac Dawkins off the road because Isaac was dating Breanne Scarber. Now we're going to refer to this as the Black's Bluff Road incident, and this final prior difficulty is hard to pin down, but at trial, Jay identifies this transaction as an incident that occurred out on Black's Bluff Road. Here's what he said before trial, though, in his first statement to Sutton.
We were going through town again. This time we was on a shorter avenue in front of the Dwarf House, I believe. And just out of circumstance, I guess, we got up beside a red Firebird, and we didn't know it was nobody in particular until we got up beside him. And we were in Isaac's truck again then, and we got up beside him, and then next thing we noticed that they were staying right beside us, and then I happened to look over, and they had rolled down the windows, and then I could see it was Joey and Kevin Poole, and they just kept on kind of staring at us, and then, you know, me and Isaac was just, we recognized who it was, so we was looking back at them, and we stayed like that for probably 5 minutes, just going through traffic beside each other, and then Joey turned off. And as they were turning off, you know, they shot us a bird and everything. And we didn't think nothing else about it. We went on, I think it was going to Walmart that night. And another time we'd been in Isaac's truck and Joey had said something about wanting to go meet and fight. And so we'd followed Joey back out to Black's Bluff Road through South Rome. And they went to Black's Bluff Road and they pulled over on Black's Bluff Road. And, so Isaac pulled over right behind him, and Isaac was driving Isaac's truck, and Isaac got out, and when Isaac got out, Joey sped off, and then, you know, we didn't follow him anymore, we just got back in the truck and left after that.
Is Joey by himself then?
I couldn't tell, his windows were so dark.
When did this happen?
This is probably about, this was after him and Breanne had already broken up.
And Joey?
No, this is after Isaac and Breanne. Broken up or quit talking or whatever.
Well, what was all this problem stemming over?
Breanne Scarber.
There may be a reason to wonder, though, about how good Jay's memory of this event really is. Because Joey's cousin, Kevin Poole, was with Joey that night. And although Jay seems to recall someone being with Joey, well, who that person was, Jay seems to need a little bit of assistance.
Okay. Was anybody with him during that time?
Adam Elrod was in the back, and then I think Kevin Poole, I think, was in the back also.
Apparently, there's something about cops and witnesses named Jay. But if you listen carefully, you can hear Stanley Sutton in the background there when Jay forgets the name of Kevin Poole, whispering softly to remind Jay what to say next.
Adam Elrod was in the back, and then I think... Kevin Poole, I think, was in the back also.
Now, at the trials for both Joey and Mark Free, Jay drops the part of the story about Joey inviting them to a fight and straight up admits that he and Isaac began pursuing Joey after Joey and his passenger, Kevin Poole, flipped them the bird. Now, here's Jay testifying at Mark Free's trial.
Now, tell us about another incident that started out on Shorter and ended up on Black's Bluff.
Okay. We were in Isaac's truck and we were going down Shorter towards the Walmart and everything, and we seen Joey's car pass us, and they we just didn't really think nothing else about it, and then we just kept seeing them more that night. And then they got up beside us and shooting the spurge and just kind of mouthed back and forth to us, and then we wound up following them. They kept motioning for with their hands for us to follow them, so we kept following them, and then Isaac finally got tired of following him on Black's Bluff Road and pulled off, and then Joey stopped, and then Joey took off, and that was...
Did Joey have anybody with him?
He had somebody with him. I think it was Kevin Poole.
Why did you follow him?
The same thing as before, just to get it over with.
Getting tired of this harassment?
Very much. We both were.
And was it all over Breanne?
Yes, I think so, because Isaac never had any problems with Joey beforehand.
Did Isaac have any other enemies?
No.
But Kevin and Joey remember things going down differently than Jay does. Jay says he has no idea why, when Joey and Isaac pulled their trucks over on Black's Bluff Road, Joey suddenly sped off after Isaac got out of his truck and walked towards them. Joey and Kevin, however, remember there was a very specific reason.
But I went and got Kevin that night, or that afternoon. It wasn't night. And I picked Kevin up. Kevin and I were going to get something to eat. And when we came down Old Dalton Road, we came to the, where you turn left to go by the mall to go back toward Rome, coming off Old Dalton on the 27. I turned off, and as soon as I turned off, Isaac just so happened to come behind me. And he followed us through town, followed us. We went to I think it was a Hungry Harvey, across from People's Finance in Rome. We went to that gas station, and I pulled over, and Kevin was like, just pull over and let's get this over with. And Kevin's, he's younger than me. He's my younger cousin, but Kevin's always been real big. Kevin's like, at the time, was probably, 6'2", 280, almost. He was big. But Kevin was like, let's just get this over with. Just go on and, do what you got to do and let's be done with it. So I was like, okay, whatever. So they pulled through and they kind of flipped us off. It was Isaac and Jay again. They kind of flipped us off, and Kevin was like, you know what, I don't like Jay anyway. He was like, I'll take care of Jay. And I was like, no, let's just avoid this if we can. So Kevin was like, all right, well, let's go to my mama's house. So his mama lived on Black's Bluff Road, so my Aunt Ginger. So we go down by where the old prison is. We took the back way. We went down Bluff Road, and they followed us. So I said, you know what? I'm tired of this. I looked at Kevin. I told Kevin, I said, Kevin, I'm tired of this shit. So I stopped at the right down the road from the Black's Bluff prison, and I got out of the car. And Isaac kind of pulled up maybe 10 yards from my car, and he jumped out. And I was like, what's up? Let's get this over with. And he's like, I'm all right. We're going to get it over with. So he goes into the back of his truck and he grabs a bat out of the toolbox. It looked like a bat. It was a bat or a crowbar or something. But when he grabbed that, Kevin was like, man, let's get in the car. So we got back in the car and we left, pulled off. I said, he don't want to fight. So Kevin was like, if he don't want to fight, let's forget it. So we pulled off. He followed us all the way to the end of Black's Bluff Road. And we turned right. I believe he turned left. And that was pretty much it. That was the whole incident.
Yeah. And Jay at trial denied there was a crowbar or bat involved.
Jay is a bold-faced liar. With my reputation and you guys knowing who I am, do you honestly think I would have turned away from him if he hadn't pulled a bat or a crowbar on me? I would have got that over with and it would have been done and he would have left me alone. When he grabbed that, I got back in the car because I didn't have anything on me. I didn't have a bat or nothing in my car. I mean, what do I look like trying to fight this guy with a bat or a crowbar or whatever he had in his hand? I would have got this over with.
And that leads to a kind of uncomfortable fact about this whole case. The only two confirmed encounters between Isaac and Joey, the only two times that we have multiple witnesses agreeing that Isaac and Joey encountered one another, aside from the ones that were only recalled a year and a half later at the trial, were the Checkers incident and the Black's Bluff Road incident. And both times, by Jay's own admission, Isaac had been the one following Joey. In the Checkers incident, at least, we know for a fact that Joey was egging on Isaac. And it's not like Joey was some innocent bystander. I mean, the two met somewhere in a parking lot, had words, and planned to fight. And Joey drove home, perhaps thinking that surely Isaac wouldn't call his bluff and follow him. But Isaac did. And in the second incident, Joey may have been taunting Isaac into following him. Although Jay's the only source for that claim, and he kind of flip-flops on that point. And seems to indicate at one time that really all that had happened is that Joey had flipped off Isaac as he drove by, and then Isaac and Jay decided to follow. Still, Joey is clearly an equal participant in both these encounters. But if Joey was an equal participant, that means Isaac was too.
Yeah, at trial, the relationship between Joey and Isaac gets portrayed by the state as predator and prey, with Joey as the wolf and Isaac as the lamb. Now, it's true, Colston acknowledges Isaac may literally have been following Joey during these events, but that's only because Joey was baiting a naive Isaac into positions where he could make a deadly strike, and Isaac was unknowingly following Joey's plans.
One of the coolest things about making Undisclosed is how well we get to know our listeners. You send us questions on Twitter, you tell us about your interest on Facebook. We feel a really close connection with you all. And in the almost year and a half that we've been making this podcast, one of the things that we've come to know about you is that you love to learn. So it's cool to see our fans' interest match up with one of our supporters' interest, and that supporter is The Great Courses. When we have downtime in between recording for the podcast, we watch The Great Courses Plus video series. The content is so rich. It covers a variety of topics, from law to history to politics. And the best part is that you get unlimited access to all that content when you sign up for The Great Courses Plus. So the course that I got into this month offered by The Great Courses is Privacy, Property, and Free Speech. From a legal perspective, it's interesting because it covers a lot of the niche issues in Fourth Amendment law. But the content is really relatable, too. It talks about the rights that you have in your own home, your cell phone privacy, and even important information about the details that you share on social media. I really think you should check it out. I enjoyed it. I know you will. If you haven't signed up for Great Courses yet, there's a great way to check out this program. As one of our listeners, you can get a free month of access to the Great Courses Plus. And not just to Privacy, Property, and Free Speech, but to all the Great Courses Plus content. So go check it out. Start your free month today. You can do so by going to www.thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. All of the lectures, all free for an entire month. Get it by going to www.thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed.
In her closing, Tammy Colstein says, "Now, the defense would have you believe that because Jay Barnett tells you on, and truthfully, good boy, Floyd County police officer, we followed him, that it was Isaac stalking Joey, but every witness who was there that is not still good friends with Joey Watkins, except for Erica Evans, who said, I don't remember what was said, but everybody who was there, Adam Elrod, Jay Barnett, and Isaac, bless his heart, can't speak, they told you it was Joey going, come on, follow me, follow me." Because the defense was afraid of a jury backlash, they actually didn't focus much on the fact that Isaac was the one following Joey in different incidents.
Yeah, and that's the difficult position for defense counsel in any murder trial, and certainly was the case here, is you don't want to speak ill of the dead. It's for fear of jury backlash, right? I mean, you have a person who has been killed. You don't want to be blaming the victim, and you definitely risk a jury turning against you if you're trying to claim that that victim had any culpability either in his death or, as in this case, in these prior incidents.
You know, I don't want to turn the tables or sound like, oh, I'm Mr. Didn't do nothing wrong, or I'm an angel or anything, because I wasn't. I was a young punk. I mean, I thought I was invincible, you know, but Isaac was kind of, I guess you would say, he was kind of obsessed with me as far as scared that I was going to get back with Brienne, and he was at me a lot, you know, as far as like messing with me, saying things, calling the shop, doing this, doing that, but in the trial, they didn't want to bring this out, because they said that it would make it look like it was poor me. You see what I'm saying? We don't want to point the finger at him because he's the one that got shot and he's dead. He can't defend himself. We're not going to bring all these points up. Even though he came to my house, he followed me, you know, and did all this stuff to me. You know, they turned the tables and made it look like I was chasing him.
Clear, it's not like Isaac was some big bully running around town trying to intimidate poor Joey. It's not how it was. But on the other hand, it wasn't as if Joey was running around town essentially a wolf with his pack stalking Isaac until he was dead.
Colin, I want to ask you, if we're talking about like admitting legally into evidence or at a trial prior bad acts or similar transactions or prior for the defendant, like, can the same thing be done for the victim in a case? Different rules, doesn't matter.
Yeah, there's something known as the mercy rule, and what it says is usually character evidence can't come in to show the defendant's sordid character, but the defendant can, so to speak, open Pandora's box and attack the character of the victim, which allows then the prosecution to respond in kind and to attack the defendant's character. Now, in this case, what we see going on is the prosecution's claim is, we're not saying Joey is generally a violent person. We're not using propensity character evidence. We're showing specific prior transactions between Joey and Isaac, which show his motive to harm Isaac. The problem, as I see it, as we look through these six examples, is there has to be some quantum of proof even to get this before the jury. And it seems with each of these examples, there's not even that quantum of proof that would show a jury could reasonably look at this and find, I think that these were incidents that involved Joey at all in some cases and involved Isaac at all in other cases. And so that's the problem I see here, is there's just such a paucity of proof here that really this is something that the judge should have screened out and never should have allowed to reach the jury.
But it is a confusing mess, and having the jury sit there for a week and having all these friends of Joey get up and testify about a bunch of, like, to someone who didn't grow up in Rome in this kind of atmosphere, kind of shocking events, even that don't involve Isaac. Yes, that's going to prejudice them against Joey, because I'm sure our listeners now are like, what the hell is Joey dude up to? But the point is, what Joey was doing was not of a character that was just murder, because that's what it comes down to. Brienne had a lot of other boyfriends. Joey never killed any of them. What was different about Isaac? What was the murderous rage that was present here? And there's no evidence of it. There's no reason to think that Joey was acting any differently from every other male peer testifying in this case.
So there were a lot of things claimed at Joey's trial about what he'd done to Isaac, and many of them seemed shockingly violent. But what Tammy Colston didn't mention, and what the defense failed to illustrate to the jury, was this: that the majority of these claims, and all of the worst ones certainly, only came into existence after Stanley Sutton began his investigation. All of Isaac's family and friends failed to mention any of these events to the Rome Police Department for nearly 2 months. In Mosher's letter to Sutton after the case passed on to Floyd County, he summarized the evidence that the Rome Police Department had found. With regards to the evidence Mosher had collected concerning Joey's hostile acts towards Isaac, he had only the following to say. During the course of talking with friends at Floyd Medical Center, information was gathered that Joey Watkins was a possible suspect due to past alleged problems between Isaac and Joey. These problems included verbal confrontations and where Joey allegedly shot Isaac's dog, as well as pulling a gun out on Isaac back in summer of 1999. After 7 weeks of investigation, 7 weeks of interviewing Isaac's friends and family on numerous occasions, this is the sum total of the evidence Rome Police Department obtained concerning the bad things Joey had supposedly done to Isaac. That's it. Let's break that down. Here's what Moser's investigation learned.
1. Isaac and Joey had verbal altercations. No surprise there, they had. They'd mouthed off to one another, and everyone agrees on that, although these were apparently minor events since no one seems to recall a specific incident, they just known it happened. And 2. A one-time physical altercation. This would be Mosher referring to the Checkers incident. The one that didn't happen at Checkers, but where Isaac and Jay followed Joey back to his house. When they got there, Isaac never got out of the truck to fight, but both Joey and Isaac mouthed off at one another, and at some point, Joey tried to punch Isaac through the truck window, but, from most accounts, basically got more of the truck than he did Isaac.
Three. Joey allegedly shot Isaac's dog, but the key word here is allegedly. In fact, the only reference in Moser's notes is his note about Brienne saying that Isaac hadn't thought that Joey had done it, and although presumably others had told him the opposite, Moser doesn't seem to have found any of it credible, or at least not credible enough to put in his reports. Finally, 4. Pulling a gun on Isaac in the summer of 1999, going back to episode 1, that's the Panama City incident, quite simply, didn't happen.
Given what would ultimately happen at Joey's trial, given what evidence would be presented against him, I don't want the significance of this report to be missed. Because if everything said at trial was true, about how Joey had attacked Isaac all the time and threatened to kill him and try to run him off the road, and many of Isaac's friends had in fact witnessed it personally, then why did not a single one of them come forward to tell Mosher about any of it? Why did they only ever begin to talk once Sutton began to question them?
The state wasn't content to show the jury all the terrible things they alleged that Joey had done to Isaac. They realized they needed to go further. They needed to show that Joey was an all-around terrible person, and so began the long, cumbersome task of presenting to the jury all the times he, as a teenager, had gotten into scuffles with others, as if that was actual evidence of murder. Of course, it didn't matter that most of these incidents were totally made up. Next time on Undisclosed.
Tired of hearing us read out portions of the transcripts of what happened at Joey's trial instead of letting witnesses and attorneys speak for themselves? Yeah, we're tired of it too. That's why I've gotten some help. Mike Kaplan and Sarah Brewerton Palmer of Kaplan Cobb, an Atlanta law firm that specializes in trial and appellate litigation, are representing Undisclosed in a motion before the Floyd County Court seeking access to the trial tapes from Joey's trial. Sarah and Mike moved the court to permit Undisclosed to copy those tape recordings because a recording of what transpired in a public court is a public record that the public has a right to access. as does the defendant who was imprisoned for life on the basis of what was said in that audio. As previous case law from the Supreme Court of Georgia has held, in this state, the public and the press have traditionally enjoyed a right of access to court records. To preserve this right, this court and the Council of Superior Court judges have adopted a rule that presumes the public will have access to all court records. All court records are public and are to be available for public inspection unless public access is limited by law or by the procedures set forth below. Now, the procedures set forth below have never been invoked in denying undisclosed access to those trial records. It's also worth noting that this actually isn't Mike Kaplan's first time being involved in a case featured in a podcast. He represented Justin Chapman, whose case was covered in Season 1 of Breakdown from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Chapman was convicted of murder after his duplex burned down in 2006, and his neighbor, Alice Jackson, was killed in the blaze. His conviction was overturned last year, though, due to the prosecution's failure to hand over evidence which would have impeached the testimony of jailhouse informant. Recently, in June, the state announced that it would not be refiling charges against Justin Chapman. And now, Mike and Sarah will be helping Undisclosed to obtain the trial audio that Floyd County refuses to disclose. A huge thanks goes to Kaplan Cobb for their assistance in this matter, and we look forward to seeing what arguments Floyd County plans to make as to why the public cannot hear what happened at Joey's trial.
Okay, Undisclosed fans, I told you last week that we are debuting a brand new podcast called Undisclosed Military Justice. It's dropping on September 20th. That's tomorrow. We are so excited to listen to it. But right now, I'm even more excited to introduce the host of the podcast, Military Justice, and that's James Wyrick. Wyrick, what's going on, brother?
It's great to be here with you and the entire Undisclosed team. I can't thank you enough for introducing me to your great audience.
Yeah, I know the audience is really, really excited about what you have to say. They've been talking on the social medias all week about it. They're thirsting for the content because they want to know more about the military justice system. So, you know, to that effect, can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to talk about on tomorrow's podcast and where military justice is going in the future?
Well, tomorrow I'm just going to kind of introduce the audience to the military justice system. As you know, we have a system that is mired down in a lot of acronyms. It's mired down in a lot of legalese and the different military cultures. So I'm looking to bring the audience into that with the eventual desire, just as the Undisclosed, Rabia, everybody's done, to try to improve that system. So I think tomorrow we're just going to kind of get our feet wet, and we then will be diving back into the Bo Bergdahl case.
That is awesome. You said something that I think our listeners are really going to appreciate, and that's getting into the details of the military justice system. You know, listeners are exposed to military justice through great shows like NCIS and JAG, but one of the best things about the Undisclosed listeners is that they like to dive in deep tissue into the legalese, the content. And in the military justice forum, it's hard to do so because it's, for the most part, kind of closed off to the civilian public. So you bringing that content to them, I think, is going to add real, real value to the discussion of law. And especially as it pertains to the Bo Bergdahl content, I know with Task and Purpose, one of the coolest things that you did was add that legal nuance to the discussion. And you're saying that you're gonna dive a little bit deeper into that with military justice, right?
Oh, absolutely. And military justice, because we have, or you have, such a great listening audience and such an engaged listening audience, it's going to be an interactive podcast. If listeners want to know, what are we talking about with administrative punishments? What are we talking about with the Article 32 investigation? Those questions will all be answered, and starting probably with the second episode, I will always have a listener question segment. So I'm happy to research and answer any questions they have about the military justice system.
So the engagement is so clutch. Undisclosed listeners love it. I know that the listeners of military justice are going to love it. Wyrick, if you can you tell us how listeners can reach you to start talking about military justice? Where are you at on the social medias?
The best way, I mean, is Twitter, and that's at PodcastMJ. And it's also on Facebook. There's a podcast, Military Justice, and on Instagram, The Podcast MJ. But Twitter's the best because it's so interactive, and I love to hear from the listeners, and they can also see my Uber producer, Dreadnought, as he assists in research for Military Justice.
Dreadnought, part of the Pet Podcasting family. They're going to love it. I'm trying to get up on the Instagrams with Atlas and my three cats. I'm late and I need to get back there. So I think listeners are going to enjoy seeing the pics of you and Dreadnought.
Well, Robbie has started it all with Mr. Beans, so we definitely have to keep that rolling.
I have maintained that we cannot let that cat dominate the pet podcasting market. He needs to come down off his throne. I'm hoping Dreadnought and Atlas can kind of mount a rebellion.
We'll have a pet mania at some point.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. So listeners, Wyrick is a social media beast. He's all over Twitter. Hit him up with the questions at PodcastMJ. I promise you he's going to answer them. And don't forget, check it out. Military Justice debuts tomorrow, September 20th, the first episode. It's going to run bi-weekly for a bit. And if y'all love it, which I know you will, we're going to flip it to weekly. So, Wyrick, thank you so much. Can't wait for the podcast, brother.
Thanks to you and everybody else.
Episode 10 is in the books. Thanks for coming along for the ride, Undisclosed fans. And let's thank all the people who helped to make Undisclosed. Lots of love to the Georgia Innocence Project, who brought us Joey's case. Make sure you send them some love in the form of money by donating at www.georgiainnocenceproject.org. Every dollar you send, make sure that they keep fighting the good fight down in Georgia. To our sponsors this week, those include Stamps.com, the debuting ABC drama Conviction, and the Great Courses Plus. Thank you for continuing to support the show. You make sure that we deliver great content week to week for our listeners, and we couldn't do it without you. Other vital contributors include Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and the great podcast Crime Writers On. She's the lead producer on the show. She gets help from Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings. Brooke Giddings' podcast, Actual Innocence, is awesome. Go check it out. Methil Telhan is the producer. That's producer. Nothing more, nothing less. Did I get it right that time, Methil? That beautiful theme music that you hear at the beginning and end of the podcast was created by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Baluki on our logo, Christy Williams and Nina Mooser on our website. Go to the website, check out the people maps and the case docs, then ask us questions about it using the handle UndisclosedPod on the various social medias, the Twitters, the Facebooks, the Instagram. Drive the conversation using hashtag Undisclosed. And if you want to send a question to John over at the Undisclosed Addendum, you can do so using hashtag UDAddendum. John is continuing to do great work over there, so make sure you listen to the addendum on Thursday. And finally, thank you to the fans for keeping with us during this amazing ride through Joey's case. We're about halfway through, and we got 10 more episodes to go. Your executive producer for the last 10 episodes, and hopefully the next 10, is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to seeing you next week. Until then...